15th principle. The highest level of prosperity occurs when there is a free market economy and a minimum of government regulations. The founders were fascinated with the possibility of setting up a political and social structure based on natural law. But what about economics? Were there natural laws for the marketplace? A tome of 5 books on the subject was published just in the nick of time, which gave them the answer. It came out in 1776 and was called The Wealth of Nations. It was written by a college professor in Scotland named Adam Smith. This brilliant work is not easy reading, but it became the watershed between mercantilism and the doctrines of free market economics. It fitted into the thinking and experiences of the founders like a hand in a glove. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "In political economy, I think Smith's Wealth of Nations the best book extant." Adam Smith's free enterprise economics tried first in America. Other writers in Europe, such as the physiocrats in France, were advocating a free market economy, but nowhere on earth were these principles being practiced by any nation of size or consequence. Therefore, the United States was the first people to undertake the structuring of a whole national economy on the basis of natural law and free market concepts described by Adam Smith. Among other things, this formula called for the following. 1. Specialized production. Let each person or corporation of persons do what they do best. 2. Exchange of goods takes place in a free market environment without governmental interference in production, prices, or wages. 3. The free market provides the needs of the people on the basis of supply and demand with no government-imposed monopolies. 4. Prices are regulated by competition on the basis of supply and demand. 5. Profits are looked upon as the means by which production of goods and services is made worthwhile. 6. Competition is looked upon as the means by which quality is improved, quantity is increased, and prices are reduced. The 4 laws of economic freedom. Prosperity also depends on a climate of wholesome stimulation protected by law. Reduced to its simplest formula, there are 4 laws of economic freedom which a nation must maintain if its people are to prosper at the maximum level. These are 1. The freedom to try. 2. The freedom to buy. 3. The freedom to sell. 4. The freedom to fail. By 1905, the United States had become the richest industrial nation in the world. With only 5% of the Earth's continental land area and merely 6% of the world's population, the American people were producing over half of almost everything: clothes, food, houses, transportation, communications, even luxuries. It was a great tribute to Adam Smith. The role of government in economics. The founding fathers agreed with Adam Smith that the greatest threat to economic prosperity is the arbitrary intervention of the government into the economic affairs of private business and the buying public. Historically, this has usually involved fixing prices, fixing wages, controlling production, controlling distribution, granting monopolies, or subsidizing certain products. Nevertheless, there are 4 areas of legitimate responsibility which properly belong to government. These involve the policing responsibilities of government to prevent, 1. Illegal force in the marketplace to compel purchase or sale of products. 2. Fraud in misrepresenting the quality, location, or ownership of an item being sold or bought. 3. monopoly, which eliminates competition and results in restraint of trade. 4. Debauchery of the cultural standards and moral fiber of society by commercial exploitation of vice, pornography, obscenity, drugs, liquor, prostitution, or commercial gambling. The perspective of the founders in the economic role of government may be gathered from sentiments such as these by Washington. Quote, "Let vigorous measures be adopted, not to limit the prices of articles, for this, I believe, is inconsistent with the very nature of things, and impracticable in itself, but to punish speculators, forestallers, and extortioners, and above all to sink the money by heavy taxes, to promote public and private economy, encourage manufacturers, etc." End of quote. After 1900, Adam Smith got lost in the shuffle. In spite of the fact that the fruits of the free market economy were making the United States the biggest and richest industrial nation in the world, the beginning of the 20th century saw many prominent and influential leaders losing confidence in the system. These included wealthy industrialists, head of multinational banking institutions, leaders in the academic world, and some of the more innovative minds in the media. The same feverish restlessness was taking hold in similar circles in Europe. It was true, as it is with all other systems, that the free market economy was in need of some adjustments and fine-tuning, but these leaders were getting ready to throw the entire system overboard. The problems of the day included a number of large-scale strikes, the rise of powerful trusts, the mysterious recurrence of boom and bust cycles, and the rise of a new populist movement in which certain agriculture and labor groups were demanding that the government get involved in the redistribution of the wealth. Many of these problems were either caused or aggravated by the very people who were demanding a new system. The new system would involve extensive government regulation, if not outright expropriation, of major industries and natural resources. In Europe, certain confederations of wealthy families had gained control of their respective governments and were making a financial killing. Some of the wealthy families in America coveted the rich government monopolies of their transatlantic cousins. It was in this climate that Adam Smith and the free market economy fell out of favor. We have already discussed the rise of the intercollegiate socialist society, which was built on major university campuses as the vanguard of the new era. Collectivism, socialism, government ownership of industry, subsidy of the farmers, and a whole spectrum of similar ideas were permeating the country when World War I broke out. This greatly accelerated the idea of strong centralized government with regulatory power over every aspect of the marketplace. John Chamberlain describes what happened to Adam Smith. By the 1920s, the debunking of the Founding Fathers was in full swing. The obsolescence of the Constitution was discussed openly. The ideas of Adam Smith were considered archaic. John Chamberlain, one of the foremost writers of our own day, was just coming up through college. He describes the academic climate of that era. Quote, "When I was taking a minor in economics as a congruent part of a history major back in the 1920s, Robert Hutchins had not yet started his campaign to restore a reading of the great books to college courses. So we never read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. We heard plenty about it, however. The professors treated it condescendingly. We were told it was the fundamentalist Bible of the old dog-eat-dog type of businessman." The businessmen in that Mencanian time were considered the natural enemies of disinterested learning. We, as students, regarded them as hypocrites. They talked competition and invoked the name of Adam Smith to bless it. Then they voted for the high-tariff Republican Party. Somehow Adam Smith, as the man who had justified a business civilization, got the blame for everything. We weren't very logical in those days, and we were quite oblivious to our own hypocrisy in making use of our businessmen fathers to pay our college tuition fees and to stake us to trips to Europe. End of quote. Adam Smith out, Karl Marx in. John Chamberlain eventually came to realize what the intellectual leaders of the day were doing. They were deprecating the founders and the free market economy to create a vacuum which would then be filled with a completely new formula. Their new economic nostrum was the very toxin the founders had warned against. Chamberlain described what happened. Quote, "The depression that began in 1929 is generally considered the watershed that separates the new collectivist age from the old or rugged individualist age. Before Franklin Roosevelt, we had had the Republic, checks and balances, limited government, inalienable rights to property and liberty, and all that. After 1933, we began to get the centralized state and interventionist controls of industry. Actually, however, the inner spirit of the old America had been hollowed out in the 20s. The colleges had ceased to teach anything important about our heritage. You had to be a graduate student to catch up with the Federalist Papers or with John Calhoun's Disquisition on Government or with anything by Herbert Spencer or with The Wealth of Nations. We were the ignorant generation. The Depression began our education, but the first great book in economics that we read was Marx's Capital. We had nothing to put against it. Talk of planning filled the air. We read George Soule and Stuart Chase on the need for national blueprints and national investment boards and government investment. Keynes was still in the future, but his system was already being laid brick by brick, and Adam Smith was still a word of derision. End of quote. The rediscovery of Adam Smith. My own education was similar to that of John Chamberlain. I was less than a decade behind him. We were all part of a generation of lost Americans who had to rediscover our heritage the hard way. For nearly a quarter of a century, the founders had been relegated to the pre-industrial past. Certain professors spoke disparagingly of what they called the myths the founders believed. The founding fathers were all very old-fashioned. Gradually, however, the intellectual light of day dawned on many thousands of that lost generation. Ivor Thomas wrote a book, The Socialist Tragedy, explaining what socialism had done to Europe. Max Eastman wrote his Reflections on the Failure of Socialism, explaining what socialism had done to America and to the world. For some, there was a genuine awakening. The traditional values of the founders began to emerge with the new message of promise so long neglected. John Chamberlain describes his rediscovery of Adam Smith. Quote, "We had to rediscover the real Adam Smith the hard way by living our mistakes and by being led to the whole body of literature of freedom that had created the American federal system. Only then were we able to appreciate Smith. Ironically, our education paralleled that of Adam Smith himself, which took place over a period of a dozen years between the close of the Seven Years' War and the outbreak of the American Revolution. We would have been saved so much trouble if we had only been compelled to read and digest The Wealth of Nations in the first college course in economics, with James Madison political theory as a side dressing. Smith's book is indeed the beginnings of everything that is important to economic theory, the lack of clarity on value theory notwithstanding. It should be the natural starting point for students of economics for the simple and compelling reason that it anticipated Ludwig von Mises by a full century and a half in considering economics as part of a wider science of human choices. Smith backed into his study by way of a general preoccupation with human destiny in a way that should be utterly convincing to our own pragmatic day. End of quote. As this book goes to press, America is strenuously struggling to restore a few of the lost jewels of the founders' treasury. An appreciation for Adam Smith is looming larger. If it continues, there is hope for a brighter future for the next generation than for the one just passing. A genuine return to the founders, however, will also involve the completion of something which has never been done, neither in the founders' day nor in ours. It is the need for a genuine monetary reform along the lines the founders envisioned but were never able to launch. Our responsibility of government never completely fulfilled. At the Constitutional Convention, the founders determined that they would make the American dollar completely independent of any power or combination of powers outside of the American people. They therefore gave the exclusive power to issue and control money to the people's representatives, the Congress, and forbade anybody, even the states, to meddle with it. Not only was Congress to be held responsible for the issuing of money, but it was to see that its purchasing power remained fixed. In other words, the value of the money was to remain steady and reliable, not only in the United States, but also in relation to foreign money. They therefore stated in the Constitution that Congress would have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin. All money was to be coined in precious metal. Paper notes were to be promises to pay in gold and silver, not legal tender as such. States were strictly forbidden to allow debts to be paid except in terms of gold and silver. Washington stated, quote, "We should avoid the depreciation of our currency, but I conceive this end would be answered as far as might be necessary by stipulating that all money payments should be made in gold and silver, being the common medium of commerce among nations." End of quote. What went wrong? Here is one area where a great idea of the founders was never adequately implemented. The founders were just coming out of a devastating depression when the Constitution was adopted, and under pressure from both European and American financial interests, a whole series of policy errors were committed, which have continued to this day. For example, the issuing of money was turned over to a private consortium of bankers who set up a privately owned bank called the Bank of the United States. A similar arrangement exists today under the Federal Reserve System. The indignant protest of Thomas Jefferson can be heard across the vista of two whole centuries. Quote, "If the American people ever allow the banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property, until their children will wake up homeless on the continent their fathers occupied. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to Congress and the people to whom it belongs." End of quote. Fractional banking. The bank was allowed to issue 3 or 4 times more paper notes or loans than it had in assets. This is called fractional banking because the bank has only a fraction of the assets needed to back up the paper currency or credit which it has issued. Once again, Jefferson protested. The banks themselves were doing business on capitals or assets, three-fourths of which were fictitious. Jefferson saw that the banks would inflate the economy by loaning out fictitious paper money with no assets behind it. This would boom the economy. Then, when the financiers had lured borrowers into a precarious position, they would call for a bust and foreclose on property for which the bank had virtually furnished nothing. At the first signs of a pending bust, Jefferson lamented, quote, "This fictitious capital is now to be lost and to fall on somebody. It, the bank, must take on those who have property to meet it, and probably on the less cautious part who, not aware of the impending catastrophe, have suffered themselves to contract or be in debt, and must now sacrifice their property of a value many times the amount of the debt. We have been truly sowing the wind, and are now reaping the whirlwind." End of quote. Amazingly, this disastrous pattern of boom and bust has been repeated off and on for over 200 years, without the cause of it being corrected. A sound monetary reform program is still begging for a hearing. An economy of debt instead of wealth. The financiers who gained control of American finance built the economy on debt instead of wealth. Jefferson's protest came out as follows, quote, "At the time we were funding our national debt, we heard much about a public debt being a public blessing, that the capital representing it was a creation of active capital for the ailment of commerce, manufactures, and agriculture. This paradox was well adapted to the minds of believers in dreams." End of quote. Jefferson, Jackson, and Lincoln all tried to get the monetary program turned around so that Congress would issue its own money and banks would be required to loan on existing assets rather than use fictitious money based on merely a fraction of their assets. In other words, they wanted to get rid of the boom and bust cycle. At one point, when the idea seemed to be catching on, the London Times came out with a frantic editorial stating, quote, "If that mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in the North American Republic during the late war in that country, the Civil War, should become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off its debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of the civilized governments of the world. The brains and the wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." End of quote. A pressing opportunity. All of this should demonstrate that somewhere up the trail, the leadership of the United States has an opportunity to add one more burst of momentum to the upward thrust of the 5,000-year leap. It will be a monumental monetary reform based on the principles which the founders understood but were never able to implement. As Jefferson said toward the latter days of his life, quote, "We are overdone with banking institutions which have banished the precious metals and substituted a more fluctuating and unsafe medium. These have withdrawn capital from useful improvements and employments to nourish idleness. These are evils more easily to be deplored than remedied." End of quote. On another occasion, Jefferson lamented, quote, "We are completely saddled and bridled, and the bank is so firmly mounted on us that we must go where it will guide. End of quote.